Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. First item, we'll have an introduction of members. I guess we could introduce ourselves. So, Representative Post, if you'd like to start out, we'll.
All right, I'd be glad to. Representative Bill Post from House District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And my second term here, serving under our great chairman, Jeff Barker.
I'm not the president, you don't need to do that. But thank you.
You're reminding him.
Representative Gorsuch is not here today. He had an emergency medical issue he had to take care of. Representative Springer, please.
Hi, I'm Sherry Springer, state rep from House District 17. So that includes the small towns of Sile, Lebanon, Sweet Home, Waterloo, Staten, Sublimity, Gates, Mill City, Lyons, Detroit, and Idana. That would be 11, and there'll be a quiz in a couple minutes. And I love that district. What else? Was that it? That's who I am. Good enough. Right,
I'm Ann Leininger. I represent Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland. It's House District 38, and I'm very excited to be serving on this committee again, and I'm excited about the new members who are joining us.
Andy Olson, State Representative from Albany.
And Jeff Barker, I'm a State Representative from Beaverton, Iowa, and I certainly appreciate my two co-chairs, Representative Olson and Representative Williamson.
Jennifer Williamson, House District 36, Northwest, Southwest, Portland, including downtown, and I am just thrilled to be back.
I'm Mitch Greenlick, State Representative from House District 33, next door neighbor to Representative Williamson's district, Northwest Portland, out into unincorporated Washington County. And this is my eighth term in the building, and I'm very happy to be back on this committee.
Dwayne Stark, District 4 in Southern Oregon, and after my first session where I spent way too much time in here, I finally wore out the Chair Barker and Majority Leader Williamson and Speaker Kotek and finally convinced them to just put me on the committee so I could have a more comfortable seat.
Fair enough.
Tana Sanchez, representing House District 43, North and Northeast Portland.
I'm Rich Vile, House District 26. Shoals, Sherwood, Wilsonville, South Hillsboro, about 20,000 new homes a year over the next few years. It's a really fast-growing area. And after spending so many hours sitting where you're sitting today, I hope the deer in the headlights look isn't too apparent as I sit on this side of the dais.
Okay, thank you, and welcome to the new, especially the new members. Welcome to the old ones back. We appreciate everybody here today. Adoptions. The adoption of committee rules.
You're going to open up a work session?
It's organizational meeting. So
okay. Fine. All right.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2017.
Thank you. Chair Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 1st, 2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, motion passes, and the rules are adopted.
Now we need work session.
Okay, now on this next one. Okay. We'll open a work session on the following bills. A vote in favor of introducing legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of a member's opinion or position on the contents of the concept.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 2566, which is dated 11-2-2016, 3271, dated 1-5-2017, 3412, dated 1-5-2017, 3413, dated 1-4-2017, 3414, dated 1-4-2017, 3415, dated 1-3-2017, 3416, dated 1-26-2017, 3417, dated 1-4-2017, 3418, dated 1-25-2017, 3419, dated 1-27-2017, 3420, dated 1-27-2017, LC 3421, dated 1-27-2017, 3422, dated 1-27-2017, 3423, dated 1-30-2017, 3424, dated 1-30-2017, 3425, dated 1-12-2017, 3426, dated 1-11-2017, LC 3427, dated 1-25-2017. And as a courtesy, Mr. Chair, I would like to hand off the remainder of these to my to the other vice chair.
All right.
Representative Williams, so she's so good at that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, LC number 3428, dated 1-30-2017. LC 3429, dated 1-25-17. LC 3430, dated 1-27-17. LC 3431, dated 1-26-17. LC 3432, dated 1-27-17. LC 3433, dated 1-25-17. LC 3434, dated 1-27-17. LC 3435, dated 12-28-16. LC 3436, dated 1-25-17. LC 3437, dated 1-26-2017. LC 3438, dated 1-27-17. LC 3439, dated 1-26-17. LC 3440, dated 1-25-17. LC 3441, dated 1-19-17. LC 3442, dated 1-27-17. LC 3446, dated 1-4-17. LC 3447, dated 1-4-17. LC 3448, dated 1-3-17.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can you repeat those? I think I missed one.
I've got the list for you, Mitch.
Oh, yeah. I could, but no, we're not. Representative Olson moves to introduce the LCs as committee measures. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, the only thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing I want to just make sure that I'm on the record, unfortunately, Representative Leininger has already had to go through this today with Representative Gomberg and I. We're going to carry on our old tradition from last year of really questioning the use of the emergency clause. And so there are seven of these that have the emergency clause on them. I just want to make sure that we're very cautious and careful with that and that there is truly an emergency of some sort, and if so, that it would be explained. Or if it's possible to have it during the process removed and given at least the 91 days or something else. So I just want to make sure that we're on the record.
Thank you for that, Representative Post. And then as these bills come up, we can take a look at them during the hearings.
Thank you.
So thank you. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, next, open an informational hearing from the Oregon overview of the Oregon Judicial Department, Honorable Ray Reeves.
Yes, sir.
It's too early. He said it. Honorable Jack Landau and Bruce Miller, Senior Staff Counsel, please. I apologize.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel for the State Court Administrator. For those of you who are not familiar with us, the Kingsley Click is the State Court Administrator. She is responsible for statewide administration and day-to-day operations of the Oregon Judicial Department. When I appear before you, I appear on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to give you an overview of OJD. I'd like to take a moment to introduce our presenters. To my immediate right is the Honorable Jack L. Landau, and to my far right is the Honorable Reeves Kistler, both Associate Justices on the Oregon Supreme Court. Justice Kistler joined the court in 2003. He attended Georgetown University Law Center, where he graduated summa cum laude in 1981. He began his legal career as a law clerk for the Honorable Charles Clark, Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, and then a law clerk for the Honorable Louis F. Powell, Jr. of the Supreme Court of the United States. He then moved on to become a litigation associate at Stoll Reeves, a law firm in Portland. until 1987, when he joined the Oregon Department of Justice as an assistant attorney general, representing the state in civil and criminal appeals before state and federal courts. In 1999, he joined the Oregon Court of Appeals as a judge and served there until he went to the Oregon Supreme Court. He's taught state constitutional law as an adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark. He's a former member and vice chair of the Oregon Board of Bar Examiners and a former member of the National Association of Attorneys General. Justice Landau joined the court in 2011. He attended Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College and graduated in 1980. He began his legal career as a law clerk for the Honorable Robert C. Bologna of the United States District Court for the District of Oregon. He then became an associate and later a partner in the Portland law firm of Lindsay Hart, Neal and Wigler. In 1989, he joined the Department of Justice as an assistant attorney general and attorney in charge in the Special Litigation Unit. In 1991, he became the Deputy Attorney General. In 1993, he became a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals, where he served until he joined the Supreme Court. Disdaining sleep and free time, he also obtained his LLM, a Master of Laws, from the University of Virginia School of Law in 2001. He has taught legislation at both Willamette and Lewis and Clark, and he's written numerous articles for law reviews and other publications. So I'll turn it over to Justice Landau to begin.
Mr. Chair, before we start, can I say one thing? Everything I know about legislation I learned from Justice Landau, so if you don't like what I do, blame it on him. it was
I don't know where to go
class.
From there.
It's a great class.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Landau, Oregon Supreme Court, I want to begin by thanking all of you for inviting us here to talk to you about the work of our courts. As I understand our charge, it is to give you an overview of the judicial branch, who we are, what we do, a rough outline of how we do it, how we interact with the other branches, and so forth. I'll begin this conversation with a kind of historical overview of how the courts got organized the way they are, and then my friend and colleague Justice Kistler will pick up from there and address some more specific issues about how the branches of government interact. Please, though, interrupt us with any questions along the way. Don't be bashful. We welcome any opportunity to be helpful here this afternoon. The role of the courts in our system of government is unfortunately a little understood subject. As I explained to Senate Judiciary Committee this morning, I'm always reminded of a tour that I gave of a group of middle school students at the court, and one of the kids raised his hand and said, "Are you a real judge?" And I said, "Yes, I'm a real judge." And he looked at me somewhat skeptically and said, "Yeah? Well, what channel are you on?" There is a lot more to the work of the courts than what people typically derive from television depictions. And so what we'll do is give you this very, very brief overview. I apologize, it is so brief. It's kind of like the speed dating approach to how the courts operate. But as I said, if there are any questions, please let us know. The courts are actually a very, very important part of our divided system of government. We are one of the three branches that comprise our state government, the House and the Senate together, the legislature being one branch, the governor, the executive branch, and the courts, the third branch. Without that third branch, government will not work. It's the court system that provides the way for everyone, businesses, individuals, local governments, even state government itself, to resolve disputes peaceably, fairly, and in accordance with the rule of law. The importance of our court system dates back
very early in our state's history. In fact, there was a court before there was a state. In 1841, a pioneer by the name of Ewing Young died without having made a will. And the problem was that he owned most of what we now know as the Chehalem Valley. And his fellow pioneers wanted to know who gets that land now that he's dead. And so a group of them met at Shampui, and they decided to talk about putting together a provisional government. They ended up putting off the provisional government part of it. What they didn't put off was the appointment of a supreme judge, a court clerk, a sheriff, and two constables. We had a justice system before we even had a territory. Years later, in 1857, when the framers of our Constitution met here in Salem, they created the three branches of government that we now see in our Constitution, one of which was designated as the Supreme Court. Actually, it was the Supreme Court, spelling not being quite as precise a matter in those days. If you actually look at the handwritten version of our Constitution, it's spelled Supreme. The Supreme Court consisted in those days of four judges. The way it worked was that the framers were trying to be very, very fiscally conscious in those days, and they divided the state into four districts, assigned each of the four judges to one of those districts, and then required them to act as circuit judges. The term circuit judges refers to judges who got on their horses and rode circuit around that district, conducting trials in each of the towns in that district. Then if some litigant wanted to appeal a decision made by that judge, the other three judges would serve as the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court consisted of this kind of moving combination of the other three judges who didn't make the decision that was the subject of the appeal. As the state grew, so did the workload on those four judges, and the legislature ultimately decided to separate this kind of two-for-one judge system that we had into two separate court systems. The legislature in 1878 created a system of circuit court judges, one for each county. And this is a real important point for us to remember. Back in those days, the circuit court judges were employees of the counties. They met in county courthouses that were built and funded by the counties. They worked with county staff, paid out of county budgets. Separate from that was the Supreme Court, which was paid out of the state's general fund and were state employees. Over the course of the 20th century, the legislature increased the number of Supreme Court judges, first from 3 to 5, then from 5 to 7, and it remains at 7 to this day. In the meantime, in 1961, the legislature created the Oregon Tax Court because of a growing number of cases that involved state taxation. And because of the specialization involved there, the legislature created a specialty court, and appeals from the tax court go directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. In 1969, the Supreme Court found itself drowning in appeals, largely because of an increase in the population of the state, but also because of an increase in litigation that resulted from United States Supreme Court cases dealing with expanding the rights of litigants in criminal cases. In response to that increased workload, the legislature created an intermediate court of appeals. So now we have three layers of courts as of 1969. You have the first layer, trial judges in the circuit courts in each county. Appeals then go to the intermediate court, the Court of Appeals. And then if somebody's dissatisfied with a decision of the Court of Appeals, you can take a request to the Supreme Court to take a case to be decided by the highest court. In the 1980s, the legislature decided that although this three-tiered system made sense, the way that the court system was administered didn't. Recall that you have all the circuit courts that are paid out of county budgets as opposed to the appellate courts that are paid out of the state budget. The problem there was a significant amount of disparity from one county to another in the funding of the courts. And there were also some administrative inefficiencies when you have a lot of overlap in the administration of the court system. And so in 1983, the legislature adopted legislation creating what is known as a unified court system. So now, since 1983, all of the employees that work for our state courts, trial courts, courts of appeal, or court of appeals, and the Supreme Court, we are all state employees. Interestingly enough, though, the buildings in which the trial courts conduct their business remain county courthouses, which is an issue that you'll no doubt come across in the course of the session. Let's talk a little bit about how each of these three tiers works today. In the first tier are the circuit courts. There are 173 judges in 27 judicial districts. The reason there are 27 is that some of the counties, what used to be separate county courthouses, they were combined into single judicial districts. The circuit courts are known as courts of general jurisdiction. They hear practically every kind of case imaginable. Criminal, civil, domestic relations, small claims, juvenile delinquency, child support, termination of parental rights, foreclosure, debt collection, landlord, tenant, you name it, the circuit courts hear it. Their workload is breathtaking. Every year, the circuit courts in our state receive upwards of around 600,000 filings. They've processed 6 million cases in the last 10 years. The largest share of the circuit court workload is criminal cases. Usually from district to district, it's between 30% and 40% of the workload. The second tier is the Court of Appeals. It now consists of 13 judges. The 13 judges divide up into panels of three, so we have four panels of three judges, and then the odd judge is the chief judge, who's the administrator of the Court of Appeals. That court is a court of what's called mandatory jurisdiction. It doesn't get to pick and choose its cases. It takes anything and everything that comes up from those 27 judicial districts. Plus, it also takes appeals from all of the administrative agencies, the boards and commissions that render decisions in administrative cases. The Court of Appeals has a national reputation as being one of the hardest working and busiest intermediate courts of appeals in the entire country. The judges receive somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 appeals every year, and it issues somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 written opinions every calendar year. Parties who lose before the Court of Appeals can then file what's called a petition for review in our court, the Supreme Court. We generally receive somewhere around 800, 1,000 petitions for review every year, and then we choose 7 to 10% of those cases, 75, 80 cases a year. We pick the cases that we think are most likely to have the greatest effect on the citizens of Oregon, the most significant legal issues. In addition, the legislature has assigned a number of categories of cases that we don't have discretion over. They're automatically coming directly to us: death penalty cases, attorney discipline cases, ballot title cases, tax court cases, judicial discipline cases, prison siting disputes, and things like that come directly to us. And on top of that, the Supreme Court stands ready to hear cases that come to us on an emergency basis by special writs and emergency petitions. To accomplish all this work requires the efforts of some 200 total judges and 1,900 professional staff, overseen by the Chief Justice and the Office of the State Court Administrator. This includes keeping track of court records, education and training of judges and staff, operating the state law library, providing interpreter services, and many other things. The budget for carrying on this work is less than 3% of the state's general fund budget, and most of that goes to trial court operations. Collectively, we're called the Oregon Judicial Department, and sometimes that's confusing for members because it sounds an awful lot like the Department of Justice, especially when we call ourselves OJD and they call themselves DOJ. We're a very different operation. We are a separate branch of government. Unfortunately, it's a kind of holdover from 19th century drafting conventions that branches of government, at the time our Constitution was drafted, were called departments of government. And so ever since, we've been called the Judicial Department. The Department of Justice is in the executive branch. It's headed by a statewide elected official in the executive branch, the Attorney General, and is staffed by several hundred lawyers who provide representation and other legal services to state agencies and boards and commissions. But it's completely separate and distinct from the work that we do in OJD.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us here. I want to join with Justice Landau. We are lucky in Oregon, I think, to have a close working relationship among the courts, the executive, and the legislature. And this is simply one example of that relationship. I'm going to talk very simply just about the court's role in the legal in our three-party system. And my point is relatively simple. It is that our role is very limited.
You need to put your name on for the record.
Oh, sorry. Reeves, yeah. Kessler for the Oregon Supreme Court. I apologize.
No, thank you, Judge.
And essentially, our role is a limited role. We don't make policy. What we do is to find policy in either statutes or in the Constitution and apply that policy to the best of our ability to the cases that come up before us for decision and apply that policy equally. Much of our work, as the committee knows, involves statutes. And essentially, the legislature makes the policy choices. You decide what the policy should be in the statutes within constitutional limits. Our job is to look at the words that you used, the background or context against which the statutes were enacted, and the legislative history to try to understand as best we can what the legislature wanted. Sometimes that's not always easy. Sometimes because I think you may know the principles, but finding the words, which are imperfect medium to sort of express those principles, can be difficult. Sometimes situations and examples come up that no one could have foreseen. And so what you have to do as to court is to take the law, try to figure out what it was the legislature wanted, and try to implement that policy choice. In all those cases, our goal is essentially, or poll star, which we follow, is to interpret what it was that the legislature wanted. And I think of it kind of as a dialogue. If we get it wrong, if we don't understand the choices that you made or that you wanted us to follow, let us know. We will try to correct it. We don't have, as one of my colleagues used to say, a dog in the fight. It is, if you want it to come out this way, that's fine by us. We just are trying to carry out your will when it comes to statutory interpretation. The other large piece of what we do is constitutional interpretation. And as all of you know, I'm sure, but there's sort of two constitutions that are applicable. And I'm going to start with the ones a little bit out of order, which is the federal constitution, because it basically sets a floor below which government cannot go. That is, it sets the minimum obligations and rights that government must meet in order to conduct its business and to deal with its citizens. There's also a state constitution, which is unique to Oregon. It is parallel in many respects to the federal constitution, but it has an independent history. There are independent provisions within our constitution that have different meanings and that may be found in other state constitutions, but not in the federal constitution. But in interpreting those provisions, we look, as we do with statutes in a way, to the text and to the history of the provision. Now, they differ. Constitutions tend to differ in some ways, in that oftentimes, especially the original provisions, are expressed broadly. They express general principles as opposed to specific legislative choices that might be expressed in statutes. So the charge in trying to implement those provisions is to figure out what it was that the framers wanted to accomplish and to apply those principles to the modern day as we meet it. And again, it may be that we might have come out with a different policy had it been our choice, but it's not our job to make that choice, it's to carry out the policies we find elsewhere. And I think consistently with that sort of limited role that the judiciary plays, when we come before this body to testify, we don't come, unless somebody's doing something they aren't supposed to express our own views about what the policy should be. We will testify on things that affect the branch as a branch and the way that we administer the court system. But if the question is, should you adopt one policy or the other, that may be a matter for DOJ to comment on or for people that have an interest in the matter to policy to talk about. But we generally try to stay away from that. And we're happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a kind of open understanding of what legislative intent means. Could you talk a little bit about how you perceive legislative intent and what issues go into that determination?
Well, I mean, for me, and I think Justice Landau teaches a course on this and could probably talk for a semester, but I'm not.
I'll be glad to sign up.
I mean, for me, it's kind of a holistic inquiry. I think you've got to start with the words, because if the words aren't there, we can't add words that aren't in the statute. And you have to try to figure out what it was the legislature was trying to achieve. And sometimes you can look at legislative history. And one of the things that I think we are very fortunate in Oregon, some states, sometimes in the federal government, they have manufactured legislative history where people are putting stuff in that they couldn't get through the committee or get through the legislature, but they sort of stick it in the legislative history and hope it will stick. When you look at our legislative history, I think what you see are people debating honestly about what's going on and what the problem is they're trying to solve. So I think you can get a sense a lot of times of what it is that the legislature was trying to do, particularly where, say, the bill comes in, something is not in the bill, someone comes in, whether they're a witness or a member of the committee, that says we'd like to add this to the bill and here's why. If it gets added, why that's done, I think, gives you a good deal of information about what it was the committee was trying to do and what the legislature ultimately is trying to do. But ultimately, I think what you're trying to divine, and because we have a committee system, you're looking at what goes on in the committee to understand what it was you wanted us to do. And I don't know better how to describe legislative intent, but it is to get the sense of the body as a whole that will propel either in addition to the legislation or in a deletion from it.
You go into the committee record as well as the floor record on a date of a bill?
Definitely. And you can find, just thinking about a really small example recently, it was a long time ago, Representative Cohen or Senator Cohen was the chair. There was a full discussion about how you would deal with a particular issue, and it was really illuminating. And there was a debate back and forth, and people were talking. It sounds more like the kind of thing you would talk about in Justice Landau's class, but which form of the verb would best capture the committee's intent. And that's one of the things that we sometimes look at when we're trying to figure out what the legislature meant. And personally, I sometimes wonder whether legislatures really worry too much about the form of the verb tense. But they were in this committee, and so that was really illuminating, and it's sort of explaining what it was the committee wanted. So you definitely look at that.
But, Judge, you don't look at that in every case, right? You don't go to the committee hearing and decide, I'm going to take into account legislative intent. I mean, there's a process by which you get to legislative intent. So can you explain that?
Well, I think that's changed over my time as a judge. I don't want to step – I'm happy for Justice Landau to jump in. When I first got on our court, we wouldn't look at legislative intent unless there was an ambiguity in the statute.
Right.
And I wrote a couple of rogue opinions where I actually went and looked at the legislative committee hearings and snuck it in, and some people didn't agree with what I'd done and concurred. But it, for me, at least, it's very valuable to understand the process by which a law is made, because I think it helps you understand what it was that mattered to the committee and what they were trying to do. For most statutes, now under a case called Gaines and after under a bill that the legislature passed, that bill in the case says you're not limited only to the text and sort of the background of the statute. You can also consider the legislative history in looking and trying to figure out what it was the legislature intended. Each of us probably will adopt a different course. For me, more information is better than less information. And if I've got a case where I'm trying to figure out what it was the legislature meant, I will try to find legislative history in every case that we take under advisement. Obviously not. I think if you're on the Court of Appeals, mm-hmm. you don't have that luxury. You have more time than the Court of Appeals does. But usually I will try to go to look at the legislative history because you can learn a lot. And sometimes you learn there's nothing there. But knowing that there's nothing there means that then you've got to work with the other tools that you've got to figure out what it was the legislature meant.
Mr. Chairman? I just want to make the observation, too, that as a litigant and an advocate over the last 30 years, the sort of PGE to gains journey that we've taken, I think, is a very positive one for us as a legislature and as citizens to recognize that no longer will there be this very sort of clinical attempt to discern words
right.
out of context. Mm-hmm. And a real attempt by the court to try and figure out what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. I think that's good. So,
thank you, Representative. Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So before I say anything or ask a question, I just want to, committee members and Chair, you know this as well as I do. These two men here, we're very fortunate to have on the Supreme Court. I mean, Justice Kistler and Justice Landau, I've known you guys for a while, well, for quite a while now. But honestly, we do greatly appreciate you serving where you're at. So, Justice Landau, when you were talking about the history of where we were at with the judges and everything like that, you left out the district courts. I mean, that's been a few years back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, first of all, thank you for your kind words. Representative Williamson, thank you as well. I did leave out the district courts. When you have only 10 minutes, something has to be left on the cutting room floor. but in brief, what happened was when the legislature created the circuit courts, and as the state grew, a good percentage of the caseload involved categories of disputes involving less money and controversy, or traffic matters, or small claims. And so the legislature divided up the trial court work into circuit courts and district courts, and assigned the district courts this other work. And then in the 1990s, as I recall, the legislature did away with the distinction of those courts, and the district courts and the circuit courts all came together. I also failed to mention municipal courts, justice courts. I mean, we have in our local governments throughout the state various other kinds of courts that operate independently of this three-tiered court system that we've talked about. In some cities, for example, traffic matters are handled by the municipal court, not by the circuit courts. But I was trying to give you kind of a simplified version of the picture.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. Going back to legislative intent a little bit, share with me your thought process as you review legislative intent. Is there a clear process you go through? Perhaps the testimony from somebody who supported the measure opposed to somebody who opposed the measure? Or is it something you just look at in its totality? Could you explain to us that process of evaluation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, there is a process that all judges will go through to some extent or other, and it's roughly this. Sometimes we'll actually do half-hour, hour-long discussions about this alone with House and Senate Judiciary, but the short version is this. The overriding objective to statutory construction is to carry out the intentions of the legislature as those intentions have been expressed in the words of the statute. If there's anything that you need to take away from our conversation about statutory construction, it's that. We are limited in our ability to carry out what we find are the intentions of the legislature by the reasonable construction of the words that you actually put into a bill and get adopted as law. So that's the overriding objective, is to interpret the words of the statute in a way that conforms to legislative intent. There are a variety of rules that we will look at in the first instance. We'll look at the text of the statute, the words in dispute, in its context. Other related statutes in the same subject or on related subjects. We will look at prior construction by courts of those statutes or related statutes. If we borrowed wording from another jurisdiction, we will look at court decisions interpreting the language that was borrowed from the other jurisdiction. There are a series of rules. Some of them are actually expressed in legislation in ORS Chapter 174 about statutory interpretation. If you have conflicts between statutes, particular statutes will control over general, more recent statutes will control over irreconcilable general statutes, word order, things like that. There are a whole series of kind of like grammatical principles that the courts will apply in doing this kind of textual analysis. The courts will, whenever possible, also look at legislative history without the kind of ambiguity trigger, that kind of artificial limit that existed under PGE versus Boley. We will now feel free to look at any legislative history that's offered by the parties and anything else that we happen to think is relevant in trying to create a picture, an accurate picture of what the legislature was intending. If that legislative history, along with this textual analysis, gives us a pretty clear picture, then we're done. And we will effectuate the legislature's intentions as the words permit. Sometimes you have a case in which a statute is really stubbornly ambiguous, and even the legislative history doesn't help. Then there are a series of rules, some of them legislative, some of them judicially constructed, that help us kind of break the tie. Because courts address statutory interpretation decisions in the context of real cases. So it's not an academic exercise. It's not, you know, when I get a really, really difficult statutory construction decision, I can't just say, beats the heck out of me. Can we send a messenger over to the legislature and say, what did you guys really think? We have to make a decision based on the information that we have, and we have a series of kind of tie-breaking rules of construction based on assumptions about what the legislature would have wanted us to do in those situations. So, for example, if you have one construction that might be unconstitutional, the other is clearly fine, we'll always assume that the legislature would intend us to adopt the one that doesn't create constitutional problems. So that's basically it in a nutshell. Does that help?
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Leininger.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here. I have a question about justice courts. I was at one time a county commissioner, and the county created a justice court during that time. And it would be helpful to hear your perspective on the relationship between justice courts and this court system, and the extent to which the justice courts may or may not hear matters that would otherwise go into the state court system, and then also how the revenues that justice courts generate flow and how that differs from how fine and fee revenue that the state courts generate flows.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, I'll do my best here. I do have some people in the room that might be able to help us out. As far as the jurisdiction of the courts, there is some overlap between justice courts and circuit courts. There are opportunities for appeals to be taken from justice courts, and that can come into our system that way. On the fines and revenues, in general, for instance, the monetary obligations in a criminal case that's decided in the circuit court, that will go basically to the general fund and a few other places, but it goes into the state coffers. There are portions of that, if it's in the justice court, that will go into county coffers.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Vial, did you have another?
I think Justice Landau made the point I wanted to ask about, and that is that we really don't have the same fear that we did 10 years ago when the PGE versus Boley decisions were causing us to have this sterile, very clinical approach to legislative intent. And we're lucky now, I think, to have a line of cases that helps us look at what we were really trying to say. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Any further questions from anybody in the panel? Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate the information once again.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Oh, Bruce, do you want to stay there?
Yes, please.
Okay. Close that hearing in. We're open a public hearing on House Bill 2606.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2606 comes to you from the Oregon Judicial Department. This measure allows for the State Court Technology Fund to receive allocations from criminal cases.
Thank you.
Please. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior counsel to the State Court Administrator. Late last summer, we completed a multi-year project implementing the Oregon eCourt program in all of the circuit courts statewide. And we now find ourselves in the position similar to when you buy an expensive piece of farm equipment or heavy equipment for construction. You've had this tremendous capital outlay. You have debt that you have to pay down, but you also have to plan and develop resources to maintain and support this lovely piece of machinery that you've bought so that it will operate efficiently and to protect your investment. So in that regard, we are trying to explore ways with the legislature, the state bar, and our business partners on how to establish a stable funding to maintain and support the Oregon eCourt program. The real discussion for the best way to do this will take place in Ways and Means, and in fact, this bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. We would like House Bill 2606 to be part of that discussion because it has a statutory change that may be helpful as we look at funding mechanisms for support and maintenance of the eCourt program. So the bill changes statutes so to allow an allocation from the criminal fines account, which holds the monetary obligations collected in criminal cases. It allows an allocation from there into the State Court Technology Fund, which holds money to be used for support and maintenance of the Oregon eCourt program. It's a simple concept. It's a complex discussion, and that's partly why it will go down to Ways and Means. But that's all I have on that, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Representative Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Bruce, a couple questions I have of you. My first question is, how much is the fund right now? Do you have any idea? And I'm talking about the criminal fine account.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I don't know how much is in there at any given time. Mm-hmm. The thing to remember about the criminal fines account is that it's the money flows under the statute in a couple different directions. There are primary directions it goes, and if there's leftover money, then it goes into secondary directions, and this change would be in that secondary part of the statute, but I don't know the exact number that's in there at any given time.
Okay, follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
So the way I'm reading House Bill 2606, you're wanting to move toward shifting dollars from the criminal fine account toward the State Court Technology Fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, that's correct.
Here comes
Nancy Fields coming up here. Okay. So just.
Well, maybe it was incorrect.
Mr. Chair, Phil Lemon from the State Court Administrator's Office.
Thank you.
I don't know the exact amount in the CFA either, but every fine dollar, criminal fine or violation, that's collected by state courts goes into that. Also, a portion of every violation or crime adjudicated in a municipal or justice court set by statute goes into that account. The statute then allows certain purposes. The legislature allocates money from that account for police training, for forensic labs, for a number of purposes, and then what's left over goes into the general fund. But it's tens of millions of dollars every biennium. What we are proposing, as Bruce said, when we completed Oregon E-Court, one of the great benefits to the stakeholders and the citizens of the state is you can get remote electronic access to court documents. And so currently we provide free access to anybody who does not pay a filing fee into state courts. And so that includes public entities such as the Department of Justice, it includes cities and counties, it includes law enforcement agencies, so police departments, district attorneys, juvenile departments, community corrections. We have, as Bruce said, maintenance costs for that, and so what we will be proposing is a revenue process that will include filing fees, user fees, an increase in fines, and possibly an assessment on state agencies to collectively fund those activities that are now provided and we don't have funding for. Did that get to your questions?
Okay, let's just follow. But the way you just described that to me, I'm taking away from that you're wanting to create some revenue, additional revenue. But now I'm a little bit confused. If that's the case, are you needing 2606 to be able to have the dollars in order to be in that position to create the revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, no. 2606 by itself would just provide statutory authority for the legislature to allocate CFA funds into the technology fund. If nothing else if 2606 passes and nothing else happens, then we will be reducing the amount of money that would flow from the CFA into the general fund. So rather than do that and ask you to reduce your other expenditures elsewhere, we will be proposing an increase in fines of an unidentified amount yet to put the revenue in to pay for this.
Okay, so I just one last question then. I know there's a bunch of others that are coming at you. Did you have any conversation with the law enforcement or DPSST because they are a beneficiary of these dollars?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Olson, no, they are aware generally that we were coming to do this, but we have not had a specific conversation with them or any of the other entities that benefit from the CFA.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still trying to understand not just what you're trying to do, but the implications of what you're attempting to do in this bill. So as I look at the language of the bill, you do have things like the ME's office, DPSST, entities that are consistently talking about being underfunded. So as we add in H here, allocation to the technology fund, what, if any, will be the impact on these other programs above that are listed above H? I'll stop there and let you answer that, then I'll follow up.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Springer, the short answer is that every dollar in the CFA and the general fund are appropriated or allocated by the Legislative Assembly. And so there is no direct impact by adding the technology fund as a potential recipient from CFA dollars. There's nothing that says, as I said, money goes into the CFA if it's not allocated by these statutory beneficiaries, the remainder goes into the general fund. So even if there was no new revenue added, the ultimate impact, if you will, would be on the amount going to the general fund without cutting or reducing the allocation to any of the already listed beneficiaries. What we will be proposing is an increase in the criminal fines to pay for the amount that we would request be put into the technology fund to cover these expenses that we provide to public safety entities. But there's no direct impact on those other entities from 2606.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Maybe I'm the only one getting confused here. The more I hear, the more confused.
I'm sorry if I'm contributing to that.
No, that's okay.
Need a chart.
So what I heard, and I don't think I heard correctly, what I heard is there are extra funds in that account, which I couldn't have heard that correctly, because nobody comes in here and tells us there's extra funds anywhere. So try to address that concern there.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Springer, extra, of course, is a characterization. If you think of, I think of this as kind of a water issue. So if you think of the general fund as the main stream of a river, CFA is kind of a diversion. And then if you look at the DPSST and the others kind of have fishing rights, the legislature says, we can give you money from this, we can give you money from this. And whatever is left over after that allocation process goes back to the general fund. That's all by statute. If the legislature wanted to allocate the entire contents of the CFA toward those listed entities, it could do that. But that is a budgetary decision made by the Legislative Assembly.
Mr. Chair?
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to leave this as a statement. I'm still not clear, but I'm hoping I can get something from some other questions here. My concern, and so please don't respond now, because I have a feeling this is going
to
come
up again. I can come talk to you about that. We'll get you some numbers.
My concern is going to be, I'm quite confident as a result of this session, there will be more requirements placed on the Academy. And since that's near and dear to my heart, I'm thinking, okay, are we going to do anything in this bill that's going to compromise the additional requirements, i.e. success, down the road? So again, we can talk about that later. I'm interested to hear Representative Williamson's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil, so you're in the middle of an electronic filing fee conversation. I'm assuming that there are users and consumer groups and all have, because I was part of the filing fee conversation several years ago, and it was quite a feat to get that done. So if there is a deal made on the next iteration of funding eCourt around filing fees and the like, whatever that looks like, because I know it's in process, will criminal fines and fees revenue be required? Is this a backfill, right? If there's a deal in that arena, do you need this as a stopgap to get through that conversation to have funding for eCourt?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Williamson, the short answer is yes.
Okay.
It's not a backfill. It's kind of legs of the stool.
Right. I hear you. That's what I thought was happening. I wanted to make sure I understood what the timing was and what the needs were, and the ability to get from here to a deal on funding eCourt in its next iteration is what we're talking about.
It's the services that eCourt allows. So
right,
just
right, right.
Very briefly for the committee. In 2014, I think it was, one of the other benefits of eCourt is electronic filing. So rather than going to the courthouse or mailing the document to the courthouse, you basically send an email into the filing system and you electronically file. You can do that anywhere with internet access. You can do that up to 11:59:59 on the deadline.
More procrastination.
And so our system, the vendor from whom we have our system we contract with, charges for that e-filing service. In our discussion with stakeholders, their strong preference was to increase the filing fees that are paid with civil cases, non-criminal cases, and use that to fund those e-filing charges. So e-filing kind of belongs to filing fees. We would use the CFA money to provide the document access and other services that public safety, local governments, and other non-paying customers use in that system.
So it's
a supplement.
Right.
It's
a balance. So it will alleviate the pressure of having the civil bar pay for everybody's access.
Absolutely.
So there's a recognition that there are users that are state users that aren't going to be providing funding towards the system, and this is the state's way to pay for the state's users. On
state and local, yes.
Okay.
Representative. Okay. Representative Vile.
I'm still not clear on your irrigation ditch example.
I probably confused things more than I clarified with that. I'm sorry.
So we've got training and forensics that are getting a chunk of money right now. Are you suggesting that there would be any attempt at all to reduce that chunk of money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, that's strictly a legislative decision on how it's budgeted. This does not remove any money, does not, 2606 in and of itself does not add or remove any money.
You're dodging the question a little bit.
I'm not
bit.
Missing. No. Okay.
What I'm trying to understand is, under the current allocation system, does training in forensics, and I'm just using those to kind of shorten the conversation, does training in forensics get a preferred portion of that money, and then what's left over gets sort of thrashed out by the legislature, or what's happening?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, you're correct on that. If you look at the statute, 137.300, if you look at subsection 2, it says that the Legislative Assembly shall allocate monies in the following order of priority, and the first thing there is DPSSD, and then further down is forensics. That's sub 2. Then you go to sub 3, where we're putting the court technology fund. That's after those allocations have been made in section 2. So you go through and make your the allocations are decided in ways and means they make those allocations. Then after they do that, they go down to sub 3 and say, what do we do for the state court of facilities? What do we do for Department of Corrections and all that? So there's a two-tier analysis here and a two-tier allocation. And training and forensics are in the first tier.
I'm still a little bit confused. And I read the bill, and I saw that those priorities are there. And don't get me wrong, I fully support the need to make sure that our record-keeping system for the Judicial Department is adequately funded. We've got to do, mm-hmm. I'm a little tired as a civil litigator of paying all the freight on that, and it seems to me that if we went to e-filing, it should have gotten cheaper, not more expensive, but we'll leave that for another day. What I'm trying to figure out right now is, this says we're going to do this in a priority, but it doesn't say that there will be a certain level of funding for training and forensics first before we start figuring out where it goes. Am I correct about that? In other words, it really, we can talk about these priorities, but the way the bill's written, they're not really strict levels of priority. They're just recommendations as to what things ought to be given priority. If you understand what I'm saying.
I think I can help on this. Having chaired the budget committee the last couple of cycles, those agencies will come in with their budget request. And depending on what's happening with revenue, they will ask for a certain amount. So there's not an allocation set aside in DPSST's budget that says we always get 10% of criminal fines and fees.
That's my question.
Yeah, okay. It's more of a backfill.
Every
budget, the decision's made on how that money gets allocated. It could get not allocated at all if we wanted to put it just into the general fund. This allows for the option in ways and means to also use these dollars in that way, in priority, no more than an eighth of the fund.
So for those of us who've been around longer than I have, do you sense that this undermines the priority of training in forensics that's already there?
No, because it's in priority order in the statute. So you can't, so it's allocated in that priority, and you would have to go through that priority order with the pool of money that you have and go through the agency requests and say, what does DPSST want to use criminal fines and fees for? How are they working it into their budget? And those are decisions that get made through the budget process for the agency, but it's done in the order in the statute.
Is it likely if you look down the list and you see, okay, down here, lower priority, but they're looking for this amount of money, that actually affects the decision-making for the top priorities?
I think all of the requests affect all of the priorities because there's never, there's never as much money as the agency's request. But there's a process by which you prioritize those funds. And I don't know, Dwayne will have this, Representative Stark will have this headache of figuring out how all the pieces fit together. But the intent is not that what you're doing is jeopardizing DPSST funds. What we're doing is sending down to Ways and Means essentially the enabling language to say, in addition, in this priority order with no more than an eighth of the account, we can pay for the public users part of this system. So the allocation happens later on in ways and means, and it fits in with the budget as the agencies request it. I don't know if that's helpful.
It's a de novo allocation every budget year.
Yeah.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I will send out to you a document from the Department of Revenue that summarizes what the limit was for the 15 session for each of these different groups. And I have that here, and for example, DPSST in the 15 biennium received over $24 million out of this fund. And so it's a nice breakdown there. I'll send that out.
And they came in and specifically asked for something to be funded out of criminal fines. And so it's not like... Well, Representative Stark, to bring one for everybody. So in that way, it doesn't build upon the last budget request from the last from 2015. The budget won't start as a set allocation based on that budget. If that makes sense.
Yeah, Representative Post, did you?
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Williamson cleared it up for me. Okay. I wish you would have just sat down there and talked to
me. I'm trying to hand this all to Representative Stark.
No offense at all. But that last thing you did cleared me up. So I think I'm okay. Although I do want to mention that I do believe in our committee rules it says something about no foo-foo drinks at the dais.
Unless you bring one for everyone.
In the old House Judiciary Room, we had a little riser here so people couldn't see that. It was much more convenient, but we lost that.
Transparency, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Okay, we're not going to move the bill today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2606. Thank you. And then one other thing I'd like to do before we close, which I didn't do when we started, I erred. I'd like to introduce staff, and I'll start out with Channa.
All right. Well, please. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee, and welcome new members. I'm Channa Newell. I'm counsel to the Judiciary Committees. I've been working in Judiciary since 2014. But I started in the legislature in 2011 working in redistricting. We have a great team this year. We have Josh Nasby back here. You might remember him from his LC days and Public Safety Subcommittee. We have Whitney Perez, who most recently comes from the Marion County Public Defender's Office. We have Michael Lance, who's our judiciary intern from the U of O School of Law. Mike Riley isn't in right now, but he's our office coordinator. He's the first person you see when you walk into the judiciary offices and usually has an answer to everything. We also have Christy Arrington here, who's one of our main assistants, and Lindsay Free will be our House Judiciary Assistant this session.
Okay, thank you.
And you're an analyst now, not an administrator?
Well, so we have moved, our office has moved from committee services into the Legislative Policy and Research Office, and so we are called analysts, but those of us with law degrees get to be called counsel.
Okay, any further business come before the committee today? We will stand adjourned. Thank you, committee.
Are you?
Thank you.
Are you?